I need to talk to you about Kevin.
I need to talk to you. Why? What's wrong with Kevin?
No, that's the title of the book.
Oh, fuck, you're recording again, aren't you?
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm your co-host, Kirsten McDermott, and sitting beside me is your other co-host, Ian Mond. How are you?
Merry Christmas.
Oh, thank you. Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you very much.
And Happy New Year for a couple of days.
Yes. So this is being recorded on the 28th of December, yes, 2011. So Christmas just happened. Hanukkah just happened. We just had Hanukkah in the park at Caulfield Park.
Oh, lovely.
My son petted a few sheep.
Oh, that's so cute. Did you get photos?
Yes. Oh. Do you want to see him now?
No, but maybe we can put one up with the show notes.
Oh, okay. Well, I could do it right now.
No, it's fine.
Because we're podcasting.
It's okay.
Okay. that was saccharine sweet and cute. Got his first balloon, first helium balloon, and that was very nice too. So that went well, yeah.
Yay.
You got anything else to add?
No, Christmas.
Did you get any, what presents
Christmas
did you get?
Came and went.
Oh, no, you said that on the other podcast, didn't you?
What?
The Boxing Day podcast that we just did.
Oh, we did do a Boxing Day
Did you
podcast.
Mention then that you got the Stephen King for your...
I did get the new Stephen King for Christmas. That was one of my presents.
That was predictable.
I have a standing order.
With who?
Whoever.
What, a Someone. Family member?
Well, it used to be a family member. Now my husband has taken over.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Did he give you the American
hardcover?
Of course. Hardcover?
That's Good. Also the standing order.
It has to be the American hardcover.
Well, it has to be the hardcover, and the Americans are pretty much the only one doing Stephen King hardcover these days.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
It is a beautiful book. I don't know if we'll talk about it on the podcast. I'd have to read it first.
Yeah, so would I.
Because that's meant to be the rule, isn't it? Ian.
You see, this was interesting. This was interesting. In the Boxing Day podcast,
yes,
you...
With which we did, we should say, for people who aren't aware, we did with the Cood Street guys, Jonathan and Gary,
yes.
And we did with three women from Galactic Suburbia, Tansy and Alex and Elisa.
Including one of the other Jewish podcasters in the world, Elisa Krasenstein.
Good pickup from last month, Ian.
Yeah, thanks. Yes, so,
we would have had Grant from Bad Film Diaries, except he got some time mixed up and was in his car, so we didn't have Grant, and you and me. So
yeah, well, we were on it. Now, what I'm finding to be a bit upsetting is how you dobbed me in a couple of times, and I was apart from calling your book skanky, I was pretty good on the podcast. I was reasonably, you know, I tried to keep it nice and level. I didn't want to upset people, make them cry. I didn't want to get any of this. And how many times? In the podcast,
yes,
was the pointy stick mentioned. When did that become some sort of mythological entity?
It's become a thing.
As if, my wife doesn't use one to keep me in line.
I haven't even used it the last few podcasts.
No, because I've been a very good boy.
Because I've trained you.
No. Yeah, but a little bit. There's some training, but mostly it's because I understand that our listeners
so what's
have fragile.
What's your problem?
Oh, okay. No, I was about to get on
a
rant
gripe.
Then. No, only that I didn't know we were going to do Infinite Jest and
we were talking about Twigs
or whatever it's called next year.
Yeah, you were talking about earlier this year.
Who was?
You were.
Yeah, but
You're
I was
the
joking.
One who had the idea. Wow.
No, but I was. I didn't think you're not going to really read 500,000 words, are you?
Yeah.
You're going to go blind reading Infinite Jest. It's a great novel. It really honestly is a superb novel.
So I think this is possibly a 12-month warning to our listeners that next December,
yes,
this time thereabouts next year,
yes,
we'll be talking about Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace,
yes,
and House of Leaves by Mark Z. Danielewski.
Oh, wow, you just knocked that out. You're not even looking at books here. You really
said their names.
Yeah, no, but I can't remember the. I know it was Mark Zed something, but you just said Danielewski. And
anyway, so we'll be reading them, and we're possibly giving you listeners 12 months warning because they're both quite large and they're not exactly the easiest to read of books for various reasons.
Dense, onerous,
and I think both of them
the
are actually, both of them are actually physically difficult to read as well as
yes
being quite. Dense books.
Yes, so. I did hurt parts of my body reading Infinite Jest, and I believe that the House of Fecal Matter or whatever it's called, House of Twigs or Leaves, it's House of Leaves.
You will like it.
I probably will.
I think you will.
But I'd have to turn the book around.
You have to turn the book. Anyway, so this is a 12-month warning, listeners, and we'll give you more warning again, obviously, next year, but that will be our December podcast.
Yes. Yeah, so,
which means we should have John Richards on again.
Oh, my God, don't do that to him.
Hi, John.
don't do that to him. No, because I mean, I like him, and he was really good last month, and I'd like to keep him on.
Yes, no, we will not make anyone else read those two books. That will just be you and me, because we'll probably end up talking for 4 hours about each of them.
So. Yes, yeah, individually. So, what are we talking about today?
Tonight we have two books. Where this is, I guess, our second not really spec fic podcast in a row.
The Tiger's Wife.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
The not so loose connection between these two books that we're discussing tonight, which are The Tiger's Wife by Tia Obrett and We Need to Talk About Kevin by Lionel Shriver, is that they were both recipients of the Orange Prize for Fiction, which was established in 1996 and is now one of the UK's most prestigious literary awards. It's an annual award. It's given to a female author of any nationality for a full-length novel written in English and published in the UK the preceding year, which is why We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was published in 2003, actually won the Orange Award in 2005 because it wasn't published in the UK until 2004. It's one of those weird when and where published sort of eligibility rules. So both these books won the award in their respective year.
And I was having a look on the web, bad mistake, about the prize in general.
Did you read the comments?
Yes, I did. And there's still people who complain, why is there an award for women writers? Why can't a male win this award? I can't believe 14, 15 years after the establishment of the award, people, men mostly, white privileged males, as we were known as, are still complaining about that.
Well, I mean, there's fuss being made about the Stellar Award, which has just been established in Australia, which is a similar thing.
Oh, there is there?
Yeah. Like it's for Australian female authors. So, you know, I mean, anyway, I don't want to talk about that. That's just depressing, and I don't want to do Feminism 101 this podcast.
Can we avoid it, talking about these two books?
I think we can. We're just talking about them as books. We're just saying they both won this prize.
Okay. Let's start with The Tiger's Wife. Do you want me to read the back of the blurb? By Tia Obrecht. We'll probably mispronounce her name throughout the whole of the podcast, but that's okay because...
Is there a blurb on the back of that book?
Yes, there is in very small type. Now, Taya, you told me I wasn't allowed to mention this, but I am. 25 years old, blonde and petite and pretty, and that's been made of in nearly every review written about the book, as if that's actually the focus of her winning the prize.
Well,
and not...
the age is relevant because she was actually the youngest recipient of the Orange Award.
Yeah, okay.
So the age is relevant, but yeah, her physical appearance certainly isn't. You know, men don't tend to win awards and get spoken of.
Or get very photoshopped photos taken of them and then plastered everywhere.
Well, they get photos taken, but I mean, they're certainly, their physical appearance is not generally made much of.
Yeah, but the crags, you know, get maintained, the craggy looks and
men are allowed to age gracefully.
That's right. So anyway. The book. In a Balkan country mending from war, Natalia, a young doctor, is compelled to unravel the mysterious circumstances surrounding her beloved grandfather's recent death. Searching for clues, she turns to his worn copy of The Jungle Book and the incredible stories he told her of his encounters over the years with the deathless man, a vagabond who claimed to be immortal. But the most extraordinary story of all is the one her grandfather never told her, the one Natalia must discover for herself, The Legend of the Tiger's Wife. It sounds so much more interesting as a blurb.
Oh, ouch.
Do you know what's interesting? I noticed,
you recommended this book for me.
Yeah, but as you've naughtily pointed out, I don't seem to read the books I recommend. I would change that in 2012, right?
Yes.
But
because one of us should be positive about every book, I think.
Yes, and we're not going to be positive about this one. Although there are plenty of positive reviews out there on the web. Speculative Scotsman and a couple of other people I saw. Yeah, oh, you're agreeing with me.
It's been very well received.
Yes, very well. Won an award.
By some people.
We'll get to some of the negative reviews
in a
second.
It's been a bit polarising.
Yes, but you can definitely find your fair share of positive reviews if you find us to be too damning on the book.
I don't know that we're going to be damning.
Well, if Taya's listening to this, she might want to skip to the Lionel Shriver because I'm certain she'll want to know what we think about, what we need to know about. Look, I'm not going to be that. No, look, I'm not going to be that scathing because I just finished it.
What did you think of the book?
It's dull.
Oh.
But there are some beautiful bits.
I'd really hate to hear it when you are scathing.
Well, no, there are some very beautiful bits, but all the stuff with Natalia, who's the sort of bookending.
But she's the narrating character.
That could easily all be taken out. None of that's relevant to anything.
If you take that out, it's a loose collection of short stories.
Which is all it is.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's basically a fix-up novel written in, and that's won an award. Well, it is because, you're right, it's a loose collection of stories about the deathless man, who's one sort of quasi-supernatural entity, and the tiger's wife's story, which is, as it says on the tin, about a woman who marries a tiger.
Well, she befriends a tiger.
She befriends a tiger, yeah.
The village is referred to as the tiger's wife.
And they sort of dovetail together the two stories, sort of. Kinda. Well, because the connection is the grandfather.
Well, yeah, because the tiger's wife story happened when he was a young boy, and the deathless man story is.
But if I'm not wrong, the deathless man
him throughout his life.
The deathless man fell in love with the sister of the woman who becomes the tiger's wife. It's there.
Yes,
is that sort of
yes, that was. Yes.
That might be wrong, but there's that sort
I
of
think that's
I know, subtle I think that's connection right. running yeah. through it too. But then they've got you've got the book ending in between.
Which all justifies wife beating, apparently.
Well, can we get to that in a second?
Okay.
And then in between all that, you've yep. got the Natalia story where she's basically gone to give aid to this made-up Balkan state.
Because she's a doctor. So she's yeah.
To kids. She's giving aid to kids.
And vaccines.
And I didn't see the point of that story at all, other than the fact that she goes and gets her grandfather's belongings, which does include, well, which she hopes.
Because her grandfather has died under mysterious. Well, he's died of cancer. He died of cancer, but the place where he was and everything, that no one really knows why he was there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But what was the purpose in the Natalia story? Other than it makes it all short stories. If
well, it's a bridging narrative, and I guess it's providing a contemporary narrative in the former Yugoslavian countries.
Why is that needed? Well, they're made up countries for one.
Well, they're not made up countries. They're just not mentioned.
No, they're not real. There are names given. I can't remember what they are, but they're not real.
Oh, yeah. And you're not talking about the one she's in because that's not named.
No, not Yugoslavia yeah. is obviously real.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the...
No, but the
Balkans is real.
Yeah, but the particular Balkan country she's
the
in...
The two city-states that they're...
They're not named.
No, yeah. They are named.
The city. It's just called the city.
No, it's not. We're not talking China Mabel here. They are both named. I'm telling you they are both named.
Okay,
and I didn't read this book like 1 week ago. I read it a few weeks ago and I remember. And now I'm going to have to flick through and see if I can find names of these stupid city-states. And I know people are saying on the podcast.
Okay, because I was sure Ian, that the particular Balkan country is not named.
Okay.
But anyway.
The point being that – what was the point?
I don't know. Maybe that was the point.
No, my point was that all that stuff with Natalia is actually by far the driest and dullest stuff in the book.
It is. She's not a very. She's actually not a very well fleshed out character.
No, not at all. And I kept on the back of my mind thinking, Christ, we're going to get back to this Natalia character, aren't we? And it's obvious to me that Taya Obrecht isn't interested in her either.
No.
Because she doesn't want to go back to that character.
And I couldn't figure out why. I mean, I can understand why she's not, because the grandfather has died and there's his wife, Natalia's grandmother, is very upset because she didn't even know he was sick. It was a secret. He'd only told Natalia. So she's upset that he's died, obviously. She's more upset because she suspects Natalia knew, because she was very close to her grandfather and didn't tell anyone. And she's very distressed over the fact that he's died far away from home and no one was there and there's no one there to take his possessions and go through the rituals of death. So I understand why Natalia is not telling her grandmother things, but why doesn't she tell her friend that I've just got to go pick up my grand. Yeah, there seems to be a very forced secrecy about that.
Yeah, good
I didn't
point.
Quite.
Yeah, she keeps her friend in the dark.
Yeah, I mean, she keeps her friend in the dark at the very beginning when she first finds out her grandfather's died, because they're just about to set off for the village to give the vaccines to the kids. And she's worried that if she tells her friend will say, oh, no, well you don't have to come. Go do your thing. And she wants to go and do the work.
Yeah.
But then when they're there, why doesn't she tell her? Why is she sneaking around? Why is she – it seems very – it's a very strange
thing. And there's this whole weird subplot, which is sort of resolved at the end, about a bunch of people digging up bones.
Yeah, well, I mean – Like I said, this book is a collection of shorter pieces, is what it is. And some of the pieces are really beautiful. And I actually quite like the idea of these people coming back after the war to dig up the bones of someone that they buried in haste and not well, because they're worried. They've been told that that act actually has now caused them bad luck and has cursed them. So they've got to go dig up his bones and take care of them properly. I mean, there's some beautiful, beautiful sort of stories in there, but the bridging narrative is really dull.
It is. I mean, I enjoy the stuff about the deathless man.
Yeah.
And she plays her cards close to her chest. It's not we never know whether it's a genuine genre.
Well, I assume,
supernatural or whether it's...
Even if it is, I mean, I think it is because the guy hasn't aged and he's sort of tracked the grandfather.
Before we know it's a story the grandfather has told Natalia and it's just...
Well, it is a story the grandfather
Well, it's just a fiction.
Yeah.
I'm saying we don't know that the grandfather's actually telling Natalia the truth, that there is actually a deathless man.
Yeah, true. True.
Although it's sort of pointless if you think about it. Yeah, but anyway, then if that's the case, then it's a genuine supernatural element in the book.
Yeah, but it's also folktale. So where do you – I mean, this is sort of the line. Where do you draw the line between something which is speculative and something which is wound up in folktale and is possibly –
But we're not talking cochet here, are we?
It's funny. We're not talking cochet, but it's really funny because as I was reading it, it was reminding me a lot of Catherine Valenti's Deathless. In that it's the same use of folk tale to sort of enrich the narrative.
Yes.
It is like The Tiger's Wife, Deathless uses a lot of sort of discrete stories throughout itself. But Deathless manages in a way The Tiger's Wife does not to provide a unified and resolute narrative.
Yes.
And the bridging character who runs through Deathless is fully realized and fleshed out, and you like her and she's a character. This Natalia in The Tiger's Wife really just seems like a device.
Well, she is.
I think that's a real problem.
Before we get into the reviews and all that, I've got a question for you. Did you note that all the characters that are fleshed out in all the stories that take place in the past, so not the bridging stuff, are all men? Do you note that?
Yeah, even so the Tiger's Wife is not. It's not the story about the Tiger's Wife.
No, it's about all the men around
and about the grandfather,
correct?
Who's obsessed with the Tiger's Wife?
Did you? Yeah, so you noted that.
Yeah.
Did you find that a bit off-putting?
As if
history, they're the most important parts of history.
I didn't find that off-putting. I found the delivery a bit off-putting.
Okay, explain.
Because I mean, you can tell a story in a number of ways, and I mean, the other thing this book does, it uses what's become sort of a tired literary device of telling a story within a story within a story, and everybody is made up of stories and history is just a story and all this sort of stuff. That's kind of one of the themes of the book, I think. But you can tell stories, and you can tell stories that are, you know, if they're set in the past and the men were the playmakers and so on, I mean, that's fine, but it's comes across in the way you present the stories, in the language that you use. That's where your commentary can come in. And especially in regards to the musician Butcher, who is the husband of the Tiger's Wife.
Yeah.
I felt resentful of the way his story seemed to be excusing.
Well, we're meant to feel sympathy for him. And
And
he's a child, and he's a wife beater.
Yeah, because poor things, failed musician, and didn't get to marry the girl he wanted, and so that's okay. He can beat up the deaf mute Muslim girl. and I just felt, I thought the book actually supported his story in a way that I was quite resentful of. And I mean, I didn't feel sympathetic for him. I felt that the narrative was trying to provoke that, which just actually made me resentful of the narrative.
It was definitely trying to provoke that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think she's justifying wife beating, but there is
no.
He's a complex, conflicted character.
And here's why it sort of happened. I don't understand.
Yeah.
I don't understand, actually. I don't understand. You can tell me his past, and you can tell me all of the disappointments and the setbacks and the broken hearts he's had. And I still don't understand.
And she
why
does
that
the same
means
with the.
He beats his wife.
She does the same with the apothecary. Is that how you pronounce that? The chemist. The pharmacist.
The chemist.
The chemist, yeah, who lives in the town, the old man, who's also given, at the very end of the novel, just as when you've sort of got through all the characters, there's suddenly this whole history of this chemist.
Yeah, of where he's come from.
Which is structurally odd, and I didn't get that. But anyway, interesting enough story, I suppose. But even there, she's trying to justify his lack of action. His inability to get involved and to stop the town from hating the tiger's wife. And there's and a bit of like, well, he sort of tried, but blah, 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 he didn't.
I mean, this is her debut novel, and I understand from the interwebs that she's quite an accomplished short story writer. I didn't manage to find any of her short fiction online.
Well, it's all in this book.
But I think there's a way to present, which I guess we'll come to when we talk about the next book. There is a way to present characters who do bad things in a way that is sympathetic, not in a way where you're meant to feel sorry for them or you're meant to go, oh, I understand why you did that now, but in a way that helps you understand what they did, even if you still think what they did was wrong and you don't like
but
them.
But still provides a critique on their actions. Yes.
Well, not even that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is.
That
it
can
is
be
that.
Left to the reader to some extent. But yeah, I mean, there's a difference between providing a sympathetic portrayal. Sympathetic's not even the right word. To providing a robust enough portrayal to understand motives and personal conflict and all of that stuff which goes into making a person and why they do things, which without needing to excuse what they've done.
When I said critique, I didn't mean a didactic sort of critique.
Yeah.
I mean that the critique is you can, like you said, you can get it from the text.
Yeah,
it's not whitewashing or however you want to call it. The character. Yeah.
And I don't think in The Tiger's Wife that happens.
No.
I think that's very much pushing towards, oh, we just want you to like these people because if we explain why they did it, then you'll understand and then you'll like them.
Yes.
And you don't – I don't find that necessary. I don't find it necessary to personally like a character in order to like reading about them.
And you know what that did for me? It removed all – and I'm going to get so pretentious here. It removed all the thematic richness of the book. This is not a book where there's – stuff to do. We're talking about it now, but we're talking about where it went wrong. But this isn't a book that's going to elicit discussion outside the covers of the book, other than why I don't like it, which isn't really what a book is aimed to do. Unlike the book we're going to talk about next.
Yeah, it's funny. Even a lot of the I did read some of the reviews and the positive reviews. Most of them actually just kind of gave you a synopsis, like a detailed synopsis of the novel and just said, oh, and that's why it's really great. I was like, but you've just given me a synopsis. You haven't actually addressed why you
think the book is really
good.
There are a couple of reviews
say
it transcends writing. And I saw words like that, transcends.
That's,
it's a book that's so good it transcends the ability to even discuss how good it is, which is just a crock of shit.
That's a bit of tripe, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so good. My brain has exploded. I can't know what to say.
It's interesting because I've got his name here. Oh, this is great. Philip Henshaw, Jonathan, where did I get Jonathan from? Philip Henshaw, who did the review of it in The Telegraph.
This is a UK Telegraph?
Yeah, the UK Telegraph. Yep. I should say Telegraph.
Yes.
He basically sums up what I felt and which I know you felt, which is that this feels like it's a competent book. The readers might find it a surprising one to be singled out. It's a competent book that feels manufactured in the terms it's MFA sort of manufactured.
There's a lot of artifice about the book, which isn't necessarily
artifice.
It's not necessarily a bad thing because we are talking about literature and literature is an art form. So every book is going to have that. But this book it really felt like it's the prose is there to be looked at rather than to tell you the story and let you into the book itself.
And I'd like to quote a bit. Now, on Kindle
– okay.
Yes. No, well, I'm getting there. On Kindle, people highlight stuff. I've mentioned this before.
Yes, yes.
And this book was
– So you can share your favourite bits and
correct.
Things.
Yep. And this book was readily highlighted by all these faceless Kindle readers.
Oh, lovely.
And one particular bit they highlighted which –
But do you know why they've highlighted it?
No, it doesn't give you their reason. Oh.
So you can't make little notes.
You can, but they're not captured by Kindle for everyone.
Okay.
There
okay.
is a program for Google Docs or Google Books or whatever that does that.
Yeah.
So you can have a sort of
dialogue. This way you actually don't know whether people highlighted it because they loved it or they didn't like it.
All I know is that 53 people highlighted this particular section.
Okay. So this is from The Tiger's Wife.
Yes. Okay. So, and this sort of the artifice, as you well put, sort of comes out here. This is someone speaking. I think it's the grandfather, actually. When men die, they die in fear, he said. They take everything they need from you, and as a doctor, it is your job to give it, to comfort them, to hold their hand. But children die how they have been living, in hope. They don't know what's happening, so they expect nothing. They don't ask you to hold their hand, but you end up needing them to hold yours. With children, you're on your own. Do you understand? That's the sort of... I mean, there's nothing wrong with that sentence to sentence, and I understand the sentiment, but it's so obvious and cliched, and children, you know, they don't feel fear. It's all about hope for them, blah, 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 blah. That sort of thing just shat me, that sort of writing, and there's more examples of it. You're going to tell me, no, that's a magnificent piece.
No, actually, I was thinking of dying children. I've seen interviewed who are terrified, so...
Well, but also when men die, they die in fear. Well, yeah. But I know it's trying to create a juxtaposition between children and men and adults. Yes. But it's just so and things like my mother, 33 people highlighted this. My mother always says that fear and pain are immediate and that, when they're gone, we're left with the concept but not the true memory. Why else, she reasons, would anyone give birth more than once?
Mm.
You know, it's hollow.
It's been said a lot.
It's hollow. It reads beautifully.
Yeah, it's the words are well put together on the page. But yeah,
I listen to this going, oh my God, this was an amazing thing I've ever heard. what transcends book?
It felt like it felt very flat. And I mean, it's not that long a book, and it just took me a long time to read because. Yeah, it didn't pull me along. The voice didn't pull me along. The narrative didn't pull me along.
No, the grandfather's voice, there is something interesting to that.
Yeah.
But and that did, at times I was dragged along by the grandfather's unique voice, but then you'd get back
I liked the episodes where the deathless man appeared, especially the last one in the restaurant in the hotel.
Yes, that was a nice moment. There are some really nice moments. It's a lovely short story.
I mean, yeah, exactly. The deathless man as a short story would be excellent.
Yeah.
it's this breaking up. This really doesn't feel like a cohesive work of long fiction to me.
Can I just say one thing?
Yes.
In the end, all you want is someone to long for you when it comes time to put you in the ground.
Me personally?
No, that's what 27 people highlighted in the book.
Okay.
That's another quote.
Okay. I don't think we need to.
In the end, all you want is someone to long for you when it comes time to put you in the ground. That's if that sort of writing does your diddle, then you should read this book. I don't know what does your diddle mean, but
there's quite a sentimentality about the book about the writing possibly more than the actual, like, the big narrative itself. But things like that, there's quite a, you know, there's sort of a, it's a bit, yeah, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but there is this forced sentimentality. Yeah, I don't know.
The Room is a bit.
I was going to say this was shortlisted in the same year as Room, and although we discussed Room last month, and all three of us quite liked the book, but none of us thought it was outstanding. I'm happy to go on record and say it's a better book than The Tiger's Wife.
Yes,
it's a far more accomplished book.
Yes,
it's a more ambitious book in some respects.
Yes, because this one, as you say, with the nested stories, is doing something you've seen a bazillion times before, and I think that's why there's been people, and Ruth Fowler, for example, who have attacked the book for its MFA-ness, because that nested storytelling.
It is an MF. She has come out of an MFA, and I believe she wrote, like, part of this book was written as part of her master's thesis. So it has come out of the creative writing program.
Can I quote from the Ruth Fowler? Now, look, I want to make it clear that the Ruth Fowler, which we will
I had some problems with this review, mainly in – I think she was unnecessarily nasty.
It's violent, the review. It also has a dig at Eunice Diaz.
It's vicious. It's very vicious.
Yeah, vicious.
And I should point out that the reviewer herself says she's only read the first 50 pages.
Yes.
Which I think is, as a reader, and she's saying she's done this because, you know, as a lifelong reader, she knows when she gets to the first 50 pages and she's bored stupid that there's no use continuing. And I think that's a valid point to make as a reader. It's certainly, you know, it's a key I follow these days. But if you're reviewing a book, you have to read the whole book.
But I'd like to do this quote, which I sort of agree with, even though it gets worse than this quote as the review goes on. But my God, is it boring. That's a Thomas wife she's referring to, if you haven't guessed. Worthy, insufferably dull, and an ordeal. It's the kind of book that one reads only because a sibling or loved one wrote it. That, or you were foolhardy enough to digest the bullshit storm that the literary establishment is currently whipping up in its attempts to make people buy this crap instead of Us Weekly. It's like gagging down spinach when you hate it. There's plenty of ways to get your intellectual nutrition other than bland offerings of the MFA Creative Writing course. It's not as if the consumption of the dreary rubbish will make us into better, more intelligent people. People worthy to sit next to Zadie Smith at dinner, politely and knowledgeably conversing about modern fiction. That's where it gets naughty, when she just drags in another writer and then just throws a dig at Nuno Diaz.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of a vicious review, and it's not even a proper review.
But I could see where the review, I could see where the review stems from, because after reading the book, you sort of feel that way. But yeah, it gets, you're right. I mean, after 50 pages, you're not going to be the reviewer. You need
I think you've got to finish the book. I think as a reader, you can make the decision not to keep reading, and that's just fine. But you know, part of your job of reviewer is to, I guess, to take the hit for the readers.
So Taya now wants to know what we thought of We Need to Talk About Kevin. So we just need to put down where we're finished talking about her book so she can get straight to the Lionel Shriver.
Look, I think...
you had more to say,
didn't
you?
No, I was just going to say we have been, I guess, rather negative about The Tiger's Wife. It's not an incredibly... Like, it's not an awful book. It's competently written. It's got some very nice stories in it. And it is a debut novel. So, and I do wonder if some of the, because the negative reviews I did read that were post Orange Prize. So if this was just a debut novel that had come out and people saying, hey, this is pretty good, I do wonder if winning the Orange Prize, especially against some of the other books listed, has kind of sparked some of the backlash, because it is not as good as some of the other books listed. So I'm not in the mind of the judging panel. I have no idea why they selected it over other books.
Do they provide their reasoning? I don't know. I didn't check.
They don't provide a detailed. They provide a little bit of like, here's what we liked about it, but you know, it's not a huge examination of things. Which is the case with most awards.
But we're not being tough on it because it won an award.
I just think. I mean, it's got a lot of attention.
Yeah, it has. It has, and you're right.
We would actually be even talking about it if it hadn't won the Orange Prize.
No, that's true too. No, you're right.
So there is that. I mean, are we actually the market for this book?
Well, it's a piece of modern fiction. I mean, we should be.
Well, no.
We're intelligent 30-somethings, middle class. Some dispensable income. I don't know.
We haven't done MFAs.
What is the audience? I mean, for this book, it's not people who live in Balkan countries. Well,
no,
maybe it
but
is,
I thought but you. I mean, you came to it thinking it was spec fic, and it's not really spec fic.
No, I didn't. I came thinking to it that it was. No.
Okay.
I had no idea that the Deathless Man was actually a man who didn't die. I wasn't aware of that. I mean, I didn't even read the back of the book. Actually, I didn't even know there was a Deathless Man.
So you just completely.
What?
You just completely recommended this book for this podcast, and you had nothing else to go on except for the fact that it won an award.
And you know what? Next month's book, which we're going to recommend, which I won't mention yet, I haven't read either. It's a curse of living a full, deep life and only getting a small time to read and reading very slowly. Why am I justifying?
You don't have to. I'm just saying. I'm just wondering if some of the backlash against this book has come off the back of it at winning.
I think
prize,
it probably,
and therefore,
yes.
People think it's been lauded above what it actually is.
There's always the tall poppy syndrome. Yeah. And
well, it's not so much tall poppy.
Why
as,
is it you disagree with everything?
No, because tall poppy's wrong. Because if it was tall poppy, you'd actually think this book is brilliant.
No, wait a minute. I'm not talking about me. Yeah. I'm saying tall poppy is that she's won something. She's now being talked about in high literary terms, greatest writer of all time. Not that. No one's saying that, but, you know, one of the great books of the 21st century. People are going to come out with the knives the moment that's said. So there is a tall poppy element. Not us, the reviewers who you're referring to.
Oh, they could be, but I think it's more – look, it's like with anything else. If you just pick up – if you go see a movie and you don't know much about it and you just go along and it's a good movie, that's great. You know, it doesn't have to be the best movie in the world. You've seen a movie, you've just picked it up on spec, and it's enjoyable and it's fun. Now, if someone that gives you the same movie and says, you've got to watch this, this is a brilliant movie, it's won these 10 awards, it's amazing, it's the best thing you'll ever see, and you watch it and you go, that's actually shit. Because the expectation is there.
The curse of hype.
Yeah. So, you know, the higher the expectation, the better it has to be.
But I just want to say that I didn't go in with that hype.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, I didn't know.
No, I was actually
expect.
Just talking about the negative reviews.
Yeah, okay.
Been
I'm just saying, well, neither of us.
In particular, the Ruth Fowler one has been done after the Orange Prize.
Yes.
Definitely.
Why did you read it?
Because you recommended it.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I thought you'd read it actually before.
No, I hadn't. I only read it in the last couple of weeks.
So you would never have read it otherwise?
No, I wouldn't have.
Okay. All right.
And I also probably would have stopped in the first 50 pages.
Yeah?
If I wasn't reading it. It just wasn't interesting enough. I've got more to read, especially now.
Yeah, well, let's not talk about the Aurealis Awards. That's sensitive.
Okay, so we will move on to the next book, which is We Need to Talk About Kevin by Lionel Shriver.
You mean The Omen?
Shut up. Which won the Orange Prize in 2005. It was actually published in the US in 2003 by a relatively small press over there, I believe. I found this great interview with Lionel Shriver, actually, where she's talking about trying to get the book published. And I'm just going to read you, because before I do, I'll just read you the back of the book. So 2 years ago, Eva Cacciadorian's son, Kevin, murdered 7 of his fellow high school students, a cafeteria worker and a popular English teacher. Now, in a series of letters to her absent husband, Eva recounts the story of how Kevin came to be Kevin. Fearing that her own shortcomings may have shaped what her son has become, she confesses to a deep, long-standing ambivalence about both motherhood in general and Kevin in particular. How much is her fault? When did it all start to go wrong? Or was it, in fact, ever right at all? That pretty much sums up the book.
Can I just say before we go on?
Yes.
If you haven't read the book or seen the film, obviously we're going to do major spoilers here, but you might
actually spoilers.
Massive, correct. And you might want to see the film. You may not have any desire to read the book.
We'll talk about that.
No, well, I'm just saying to people now that they might.
Yeah, you don't. Massive spoilers.
Yes.
Huge, giant klaxon spoiler warning here, because we will ruin this book for you if you keep going and you have any interest at all in not having it spoiled.
I think we'll ruin it, actually.
Well, I mean, I've read it twice, and the second rereading was really rewarding, so it's not going to ruin the book, but anyway, so I just wanted to read this bit from, I almost said Eva Cacciadorian, from Lionel Shriver. Just talking about the book, it's really funny. She said her timing was mythically crap because she submitted the final draft to her New York literary agent right after 9/11. So she was waiting for her agent's response, and it took ages and ages and ages and ages to come. And then finally she got an email. And so this is quoting Lionel Shriver. A long, unparagraphed, associative wail of dismay, of which I've kept a copy. Quote, "For the life of me, I don't know who is going to fall in love with this novel. People in the industry are so thin-skinned right now, I just don't think anyone is going to want to publish a book about a kid doing such maxed-out, over-the-top, evil things, especially when it's written from such an unsympathetic point of view." And Shriver says she worried, she being the literary agent, she worried the plot might invite copycat killings, and she suggested a rewrite with, quote, "a lot more humour in that way which only you can do. Instead of one kid from hell who will make people sick just reading about the things he does, don't make him a mass murderer. And have him actually have a soft spot for his sister because she's easily humiliated and poses no threat." And Shriver says her agent also demanded she pay the photocopying bill.
What?
Yes, which she paid. And then spent the next 8 months shopping in vain for a new agent before subbing the novel directly to an editor at a small house who'd published her before. And that's it. And it got accepted like in a weekend. And that it all goes from there. It was a very slow burn of a book, actually. Mostly word of mouth and book clubs, apparently. It wasn't a huge critical success at the beginning. And even after it won the Orange Prize, it was a sort of a slow burn. And now there's a film with starring Tilda Swinton,
which I haven't seen. You have, so we'll talk about that
a bit later.
Now,
I thought that was a very interesting road to publication.
Kirsten, you love this book, don't you?
I do love this book, and I've read it. I read it twice now. I read it last year, or no, 2 years ago now, just after it won the Orange Prize, actually, because I heard about that. It sounded like a very interesting book. And then I read it a couple months ago because I recommended it to you for the podcast. And the second reading, I have to say, is really rewarding. Even, like, there's a lot of reveals the first time you read it, which I honestly didn't see coming. In particular, what happens with the father and the daughter.
Rubbish.
No. I thought he was estranged.
Really?
Up until – not right at the reveal, but like, it, not from the beginning.
The moment – look, I'll get to that in a second.
Because it's written as a series of letters. And
yeah, I know.
She does some clever things with language.
She does.
Which made me think at the beginning that they were just estranged or divorced and she'd lost custody of the daughter because she was considered a poor mother.
Yeah, do you know why?
In the beginning I thought one of the court cases might have been a custody case. So, but on a second reading, when you know exactly what's happened and all of the details, it's really an absorbing book. And
I didn't go in with any preconceptions. Mm. I didn't know anything about the book. But as I'm reading it, things begin to spark off in my mind.
Yep.
Which is that this is basically The Omen or Case 39 or whatever horror film you want to think of.
See, I knew it wasn't a spec fic book.
Without the supernatural element, because it has all the cliches of the evil kid who's possessed by the devil or is just evil or whatever. All those cliches are in there. You've got, and I'll list them off for you. You've got the kid himself who isn't brought up evil, seems to be just wrong. Remember that it's an episode. Well, it's only from one perspective, and I get that. But anyway,
it's only from the mother's
perspective. So all this is tainted with prejudice and bias. But anyway, the kid is born basically out of the womb evil. Doesn't talk for 3 years, and when he does,
that's
evil. but cries, babysit. He goes through babysitters like I go through solos. You know, okay. That's number one. Number two is the father who can't see beyond, can't see the son in any light but good, which is a famous horror movie where you've got the two parents conflicted against each other. One who sees the true evil of the kid, and the other one goes, everything's bright. And the third main element, and I knew it was going to happen. Another child being born into the family.
Yep.
I knew that was going to happen before the book even did. I thought 100 pages in, I know there's going to be a third child, and that child being an antithesis of the first child, which is the biggest cliche of them all. So very open, harmless and easy to be harmed. And so the moment Celia is born in this book, I knew how it was going to
end. She was the ginger kitten.
Yes, exactly. I knew exactly how this book was going to end. I didn't know it was going to be an archery range.
But she's born quite late in the book.
Halfway through. It's halfway through.
It's over halfway through.
Okay, let's not quibble here.
Yeah, but it's in the last third, I think, that she's born.
But the point is, these are major cliches of that genre. And that's why I thought, even though you've told me I'm not right, that this was some sort of postmodern take on The Omen.
No, it's not.
I'm curious to know if the movie picks up on that element.
No. Well, we'll get to the movie.
Okay.
But
you didn't see that, did you?
No, I didn't, because, I mean, the whole way through, because it is just Eva's point of view, and she's not that nice a person a lot of the time. I mean, she can be quite pretentious. She's can be quite self-centered. She finds it very hard to relinquish control or to compromise and all of these sorts of things. I mean, she's brutally honest, almost to the point of protesting too much in some way about her shortcomings as a mother and as a wife. And I mean, it seemed quite obvious to me, at least in the early years of Kevin, that she's suffering a terrible case of postpartum depression. And you just don't know where exactly that picks up on what Kevin is actually doing and what his actual motivations are and what Eva's perceptions of that
are. And that's what makes this book dramatically richer than the book we just read.
Yeah, her husband's...
Because you don't. It's
I didn't actually like Franklin all that much.
You're not meant to.
He's not...
He's an idiot.
Well, he's not very – I mean, the point where I really didn't like Franklin is when he buys that house.
Yes, okay.
And that's – like before then it was just like – that's. I mean, this, you know, Eva loves him because he's her opposite in so many ways and that's what she's attracted to and all of this and he's – you know, he's a new father as well and he's trying to cope as well and all of this stuff. But when he buys the house, after they've already sort of had a discussion about where and how they're going to move out of the city, and he goes behind her back and buys a house without – a house she hasn't seen.
Kirsten, I want to cut you off here.
Yeah.
Because you're not being fair.
To
the book and to me.
The book.
And to me personally. No, because you can't You don't like Franklin because of the house buying.
No. That was like the sort of the starting point.
No. Okay, that particular catalyst. Okay, but why is that any less or more ambiguous? Can be read ambiguously than her relationship with Kevin when Kevin was a little baby.
Because because Franklin actually bought the house.
Yeah, but for all we know, they did have a discussion about it. For all we know, this is a twisted version of her truth. And in fact, I bet you, if the letters were from Franklin, Franklin would have said, "Yes, I didn't just buy a house in the middle of nowhere for no good reason. We had a long discussion about it."
I think if you take that line, if you have to separate out things that are the truth about things that have happened, and the truth about Eva's perception of things, if you take everything out, then there's no point reading the book. The whole thing could be a fantasy. No. She could be sitting in a padded cell. She might not have even had a baby.
No, of course. But
I think you need to. The stuff that's in dispute is not actual things that have happened. I think you need to acknowledge that she's being very honest and very clear about actual things that have happened. It's her perception of Kevin's motivations, I think, that are more complicated.
Yeah.
She says, "I went on my business trip for my company to research the new." Travel, because she works for it. She owns her own company. She started a company on it's essentially a Lonely Planets type company that she started from the ground up, and this is her life and her career and her work. And she goes on a trip to research a new book, and while she's away, Franklin buys a house, and he thinks it's a really great idea.
I'm not saying she's hallucinating, and I'm not saying she's insane. I think how unreliable as a narrator is she, and how far do you take that? That's what I'm questioning.
Well, I mean, you have to draw a line somewhere. And the line I drew was I decided that the actual things that happen, like the things which are in the book as this happened, I don't think Eva is making that up. I think what is up for contention about veracity is her perceptions of mostly around Kevin but also to some extent Franklin.
Okay.
About their inner life and what they're thinking and what their motivations are, but things that actually happen.
Okay,
that's not
because this is the problem. See, I could easily walk out of this book. I don't know how I got in the book, but I could easily finish reading it and say it's a cheat about parenting. See, okay, again, I'm going to mention my son and the fact that I'm a father, blah, 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 blah. But that actually, I bring that into the book now as a father. Okay, and it felt to me that it was a cheat that Kevin sort of basically, in her eyes, is evil from the get go. It's just a scream, even from the very mm-hmm. won't take her breast, and not a lot of babies do.
Yeah,
I mean that's common. And that's common.
Some
but
children
won't
take a long time to talk or toilet train.
Yeah. But all that from the get go, from not taking the breast to going through babysitters, through wailing and screeching and screaming, through smearing his shit here, there, and everywhere, and wearing a nappy until he's six or seven.
It's just before. No, he goes to school with preschool with a nappy.
I'm pretty sure he's 6 years old.
Because Eva has to go to the school to change his nappy every day.
To me, from the very get-go, the least what she's telling us, what she's telling us is that this child came out bad.
Well, this child is a difficult child.
No, came out bad.
No, but in terms of what happens, the child
I don't mean supernatural bad, I just mean came out. It's not something that happened suddenly at 12 years old. Kevin, you know, through bad influences becomes an evil son. Yeah, okay, so that's what I'm saying. Where do you draw the line on the unreliable narrator, and we actually should feel more sympathy for Kevin? Because you're right, in one sense, that Kevin is a reflection of her.
Yeah.
And that's really part of the point, and that's something that she acknowledges later on in the book.
Yeah.
This is really – because there is a sense of nurture rather than
Kevin
nature.
Kevin is a lot like her.
Yeah, there is a sense of nurture rather than nature. She's, in a sense, Kevin's her gone really bad.
Yeah.
So I get that, but I felt I
think
cheated.
That's, well, I think that's the interesting thing about it, that I don't think there is a clear answer.
I felt cheated, though.
You want a clear answer.
No, I don't want a clear answer. I felt cheated that there didn't seem to be any input from the parents, in a sense.
But there is. Of course there is, because she's not – I mean, a lot of the time she's not a great mother. I mean, she's not. Now, that's not to say that
– chicken and egg. What came first?
Exactly.
The baby not accepting her, which, I mean, like a mother should expect that, but the baby not accepting her and therefore she withdraws from the baby, or the other way around, that she was just shit to begin with?
Well, why does it have to be one or the other? Why can't it be a difficult baby who's not evil, who's not Damien, just a very difficult baby, which Kevin is, and a really bad case of postpartum depression? I mean, it doesn't actually have to be he was evil from the start. It is this intermingling of a child who has difficulties and a mother who can't cope and a father who refuses to cope or copes in the way that he does by just trying to make everything okay. I don't think Franklin is as obtuse possibly as Eva. And at one point in the book, I think she says herself she doesn't think he's as obtuse as that. His sort of great American dream thing was his way of coping, his way of making everything good in the hope that it would become good.
Yep.
I think it's a really complex book, and I don't think it can boil down to, oh, Kevin was born bad. But this is what I'm saying. I don't think it's a cheat, because I think that there is that complexity.
See, I found it hard to break away from that. I'm not trying to simplify it, because I agree there is a complexity. That's why I love the book. I did. I actually loved it. I read it. I finished it. Fantastic. As I said, it's far richer in complexity than The Tiger's Wife could ever dream to be.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And not didactic. There isn't like long speech. I mean, there is a little bit towards the end about the nature of fear and evil and things like that from her. But basically, there's this very matter-of-fact reportage nature of the writing. Yeah. And you can sort of understand why as you get towards the end. So beautiful, complex. But I couldn't help but get this feeling that Kevin, in a sense, as a character, never got a chance. There's not that sort of tipping point, in my opinion, where he goes from, I don't mean flick the switch like an episode of The Simpsons with the Krusty doll, you know, he was set to evil. You know, I don't mean that. I mean, there doesn't seem to be that moment where it's a detachedness of the parents that, because the point she makes is that he was always mocking you, Franklin. Kevin was always mocking you.
Yeah.
You were never a good father. Well, not that you weren't a good, you were a great father.
Kevin didn't respect
you. Kevin never respected you.
Yeah.
That's why I survived and you died.
Because
that's the spoiler.
Eva's
do you see where I'm coming from?
Eva's theory about why Kevin went, or the catalyst for the timing. Well, the timing is also that the idea that he did it when he was still young enough so that he'd be tried as a child.
Yeah, that was genius. That's genius. That's calculated Machiavellian genius.
But one of the calculations that factored into it is that Eva and Franklin were about to get a divorce, and then Kevin would go with his dad and Celia would go with Eva. And Kevin didn't want that because that would be worse. He actually got something out of these to and fro's with his mother that he couldn't get off his dad, because his dad was too easy, I guess, is the implication.
Yes, but at the end of the day, that book fits so closely to the evil child cliches in three areas that I picked out.
Yeah.
That I sort of have to wonder whether Lionel Shriver was having a bit of fun, even though it's not a funny book.
Oh, it is, actually. Oh, no, there's humour in it.
When Eva is in a bitchy mode, it is hilarious. I agree.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go over it again.
Yeah, you're saying – no, I know what you're saying. And
it's actually, stupid dad. Young girl, you know, another kid in the family who then becomes a victim. Yep. And a mother who feels it in her blood that there's something wrong with this kid.
Don't forget the possible furry animal down the kitchen.
Yes, and a furry animal as well. Correct.
I think I can definitely see that. And
did you see it the second time when you were reading it?
No. But when you're saying it, say, yeah, absolutely. But I think, and if she did do it deliberately or not, I don't think it matters. But having that reading of it, I think that even makes it a stronger book, because what she's doing is taking these really cliched sort of things and actually adding that complexity. So it's not he was a born evil child. It's not that Franklin was a stupid father. It's not that Eva was a horror. I mean, she's sort of exploring the idea of there not being a solution. You know, it's like it was so many different things. I mean, I found her examination
you,
of...
No, wait a sec. So many different things. So you're saying that Kevin is the way he is because there are a number of different variables that led him to be that way. That's your reading of the book.
I think, yeah. Mm. I don't think you can...
It's not mine.
You think he was born bad.
I don't see...
Do you think that basically there was no way to avert what happened
yes.
at the end apart from locking Kevin up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I see no way. In fact, if anything... What Lionel Shriver for me is there's a real deep cynicism about parenting as a concept. There's a whole speech she gives partway through the book, which just lit it, like the bulb literally went off in my head. I thought that is amazing. Which yeah. is why do we bother hiding our children from sexuality and from in a sense violence, but sexuality specifically yeah. when really children are just us but small.
Yeah.
What is the point? Let them see porno. I didn't say that, but let them once they hit about six or seven and they
don't. Closet them.
Don't closet them. There's yeah. no point.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to go in that direction whether we force them or not. And the brilliant bit in the book is when she says, we pretend to our children that we've got a secret that they don't know about, but when they get older, we'll reveal it to them. But we've got nothing to reveal. The emperor's wearing no clothes here. So why pretend? Why pretend to – and that's the deep-seated cynicism for me about her view on parenthood.
See, I don't think that's a cynicism. I think there's a realism about that.
Yeah, okay,
I don't see it as cynicism. I think there's – I mean, there's parts of the book that are deeply cynical. Actually, that reminded me of that scene which did make it into the movie. It's a really darkly funny scene where when Eva gets pregnant and she sits little Kevin down, who's about eight at that time, seven or eight, to explain to him where babies come from. And she's sort of
did you? Yeah.
And then Kevin's saying, are you talking about fucking?
Yeah. Which is it's a great moment in the book.
I don't know. I mean, I think Kevin comes across as
how does he come across in the movie?
Complex character. Well, see, the problem with the and I really, I'll say two things about the movie. One, I really loved it. I think it's a really beautifully shot, amazingly acted movie. Tilda Swinton is incredible as always. The two boys who played Kevin at different ages were both really good. John C. Reilly.
Yeah, John
the
C. Reilly, who is perfect for Franklin.
Yeah, he was pretty good too. He doesn't get a lot of role in the film. It's mostly about Eva and Kevin, so there's not a lot of
Celia.
There's not a lot of it's a massive book, and they've condensed it into this less than 2 hour movie. The problem with first of all, I actually wouldn't recommend the movie to you if you've not read the book. I think the movie gives you a really beautiful visualization of a lot of the key scenes in the book, but there's no internalization, and I wouldn't have wanted a voiceover, but there is no internalization. It's all just external. And as beautiful as the acting and everything is, it leaves out other terribly key scenes. You have no idea what Kevin actually does at the school, except that he shot kids in the basketball court. You don't get any of the lead up to his plans and the kids he selected and why he selected them.
Oh, but that's crucial.
Yeah, so this is the thing.
So it comes off as just a random, he just invited someone.
Well, not random, like he's – I mean, you don't even know that he's invited kids. You just don't know.
Do you see the scene in the basketball court?
You don't see him shoot kids, no. It's beautifully underplayed in a lot of ways, actually. But it's stuff like this which I wouldn't recommend you see the movie, because if you haven't read the book and you don't have these complexities, I don't think you'd get as much out of the movie. It's a really beautiful film to watch if you've read the book, because as I'm watching it all the way through, all of this stuff is flooding in from the book. It's like, oh, this is what happened in between this bits and that. It was this and this is what she was talking about with this. The other difference between the book and the movie, obviously, is you're reading the book and it's all Eva. It's all Eva's words. It's first person. It's letters to her husband. It's all Eva. So there's unreliable narrator. I don't think Eva's unreliable. I think in terms of a narrator, I think she remembers correctly, which is what we usually talk about when we're talking about an unreliable narrator. We're talking about obvious deception or
putting a bias on something, isn't it?
We're talking about a deception or something like that. I think she's a very reliable narrator. I think to the point where she gives you so much material, you have a lot to work with to judge. Okay. But when it's a movie, it's a movie. So everything that happens there happens in front of you. So Kevin is awful. Like Kevin gets there's no room in the movie because it's happened. Like it's not even telling you what happened. You see it happen. You see everything.
Do you have the scenes?
And you see the looks. Kevin,
do you have the scenes in the prison? Or the her with
You get a couple, but there's not a lot of dialogue.
So it's not bookended with those, like the innocent.
Actually, the whole movie, it's really interesting that they've bookended it with. It begins. There's a lot of cutaway shots and phantom voices and things, but basically the scene which bridges the movie and crops up throughout the movie is at the beginning of the book when her house gets red paint thrown on it.
Oh, yes. Yep.
So the whole movie is actually her cleaning the paint off the house, fixing the house, making a room for Kevin when he finally gets out of prison. And that's the whole bridge. It is a beautiful film. I really like the film. I wouldn't recommend it if you've not read the book because I don't think you'll get much
out of
it.
They don't show what happens in the basketball court.
No, see, not graphically.
I didn't know.
They show kids coming out. They show the reaction.
Okay, bits. But see, this is what I found interesting and really was actually happy that Lionel did this. Is that I thought she wasn't going to show it either. I thought she – we know it happens. We know who died, why they were chosen.
Yep.
But I didn't think it would be possible for Lionel Shriver or for Eva, the character, to actually depict what occurred because obviously Eva's not there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and it's said a number of times she's piecing together from this bit and that bit and all that, and there was a survivor, et cetera.
Yep.
And she does show it.
Yep.
We see what happens in the basketball.
She recreates in her head what she thinks happened.
And I was surprised. That was actually the only surprising part of the book that she actually does it, that it's not, in a sense, washed away. Not washed away, that's not the right way of putting it, but that she just, it's there, it happens, there's no point glorifying it.
Yeah.
No, she specifically explains what her son did.
Yeah.
As if she's proud of it. There you go. That's what I'm going to say.
As if she's proud of it?
As if she's proud of it in a sort of – as if she's proud that her son was brilliant enough.
She's not proud of what he's done. She is proud and she's always been proud throughout the book of his intelligence. Like all the things he – like as when he's a teenager, not so much – or sometimes when he's a child. But there's – she says it several times throughout the book. She's like this – you know, this was awful, but my God, he must be so intelligent to have – work like to have
she's proud
done that.
Of him
she's not proud of what he's done and I don't think I she don't, ever I, is I think she's proud of the fact that he is and this is possibly the deep tragedy of Kevin. It's not the tragedy of the book. The tragedy of the book is the school kids who were killed, but and I'm not underplaying that and saying Kevin was actually the victim because he's not, but the tragedy of Kevin is that he's obviously a super intelligent boy and he's just – he doesn't know what to do with himself. He has no outlet to do that. And it's not because he doesn't have opportunities. It's not because his family can't give him things. It's not because he – you know, he just – yeah, I don't know. There's that. And she's proud of the attributes of Kevin that any mother would be proud of. She has an intelligent son. She has a good-looking son.
It's a vicious and visceral scene.
It is.
In the basketball court.
Yeah.
And I felt that the fact that the character tells us what happens, there's that sense of pride.
I just got that pride in what happened.
She's horrified, obviously.
She is, and I thought
there's no doubt about it. Her life's been turned to shit.
But the other thing is, I thought it's an unflinching because she's recording this as. I mean, we first think she's actually writing to her husband, and ultimately she's just recording this. Everything that's happened, the history of Kevin, and so she kind of has to get to that end point because, as you say, if she just said at the end, oh, and then you know what happened, I mean, that would be really – it wouldn't be honest to all of the other meticulous detail that she's put in the book. I mean, she's meticulous about the detail of everything to her own detriment a lot of the time.
Yeah, true. Like
there's points in the book. I mean, I'm deeply sympathetic towards Eva, but there's a lot of points in the book where you think, oh, my God. that's cruel.
And
that's
Tilda
stupid.
Play
because
there's this the front cover I've got of the book.
Yeah,
has this picture of Tilda Swinton playing Eva, and there's this tear rolling down her eyes. Except it could just be rain from the pain. You know, so it's really and that face of Tilda there seems to capture Eva as well.
Yeah, she's
horrified
magnificent.
But detached.
Actually, yeah. she's magnificent. She doesn't. She plays this character with minimal dialogue too. It's not a film that's talky.
Okay.
It's a film that relies a lot on body language and looks and from the actors, and then also on the setting, the stage direction, all of that sort of stuff. It's not a dialogue heavy film. And she does it brilliantly well. As I said, the only misgivings about it is that it becomes, because of the nature of the film, it becomes an objective representation of what happened. You have to try really hard to remind yourself, and I think if you hadn't read the book, you wouldn't be reminding yourself to remind yourself that this is Eva's point of view. This is how Eva sees it, because when it's on a film, it's there. It's just what happened. It's not someone telling you what happened. And that's I think that's a weakness of the film, that the book has this strength, it has this complexity. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a book I'll probably read a few more times in my life as well, because it lends itself to a rereading. That the author's been really clever about a lot of foreshadowing that you don't even I don't even think you pick up until you reread it again.
To be frank, I did.
No, it's not foreshadowing of what happens, but just little off-the-cuff things where you read it the first time and you think, oh, that was a joke or that was something, and then you don't even remember those bits, but you go back and you read it a second time and you think, aha.
Oh, it's gorgeously written.
Yeah.
But I won't change my view that for all its, as you say, complexity, and there is a richness to the book, I won't change the view that there is a strong element of the evil child cliché at its core.
But it subverts the cliche. I mean, that's the thing. She's using it, but subverting it.
And that there's a deep-seated cynicism about parenting and the complete lack of influence, in a sense, that a parent can sometimes have on a child.
True. But, I mean, that's sort of the case with a lot of – I mean, this
is what that's what provokes the discussion for me. That's what provokes the discussion. This idea that no matter what Franklin did, being sugar sweet about the whole thing, and no matter what Eva did, trying to
be a bit harsher,
bad cop versus good cop, Kevin was going to basically do what Kevin did.
Yeah, possibly.
But I, and then you asked me the question.
Yeah,
could they have stopped him? No.
Yeah, no, I didn't think they could. But I mean, this isn't to say it's a complexity of the situation and the environment and
Eva never gets the opportunity to tell Franklin, "I told you so." To me, in a sense, that's why she's writing the letters, because she wants – there is a sense running through the book, she wants to say, see, he was evil. He was. I was right. I got that too. Yeah. I really did get that too. See, Franklin?
Yeah.
But I never got that chance because, fuck it, he stuck a bunch of bows through you up against the archery thingamajig. Yeah. You know, I never got – so here I'm going to get my chance to tell you that I was right all along. Yeah. Oh, tragedy, don't get me wrong, and I miss you and I love you and, you know, Celia dying also and absolutely, yeah. It comes clear that Eva loves Celia. That's never.
And she loved Kevin.
Yeah, well, this as is I said, the thing. I mean, pride for Kevin equals also love.
It is such a complex book, and it's not. And that's why I can see what you're saying about the cliche, but I think she takes that and through the sheer complexity of the characters, that she subverts that.
Okay.
It's like saying, yes, here's the thing, evil child, good parent, bad parent, blah, 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 but actually this is really what that sort of thing plays out.
Okay.
Like. You know, this is, he's not.
Again, I'm not saying I didn't like the book.
Yeah. Anyway, so I would highly, highly recommend it.
Yeah.
But I have reservations about the movie, unless you've read the book.
And I would put the same caveat on this that I put on Room, which is about if you're not into children getting abused or hurt in some way. I've got to say,
it's truth in labelling.
The moment Celia is even introduced.
Yeah.
Not born, just the concept of Celia, my heart plummeted. Because I knew what was going to happen. Because she's following a certain pattern.
At that point. Especially when Kevin starts flipping water in her. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because it's the jealous sibling thing.
Yeah.
I mean, regular siblings do horrible things to their sisters and brothers.
Because of the way I read Kevin as a person, I think it's more than just a jealous sibling.
It is, but
there's a certain he's practicing.
I don't know. And I don't think he's practicing for what?
I mean, his way of manipulation.
I think he's been practicing with Eva that for
true.
A lot of his
and everyone else.
Yeah, I mean
that moment. Oh, there's this moment where the girls on the dance floor dancing during the prom or whatever it is, or the before they go to secondary school. And he walks up to her and whispers
because
something.
Because she's an unpopular girl. She's an unpopular girl.
And she's dancing all alone on the floor. And he walks up to her and whispers something in her ear. And her face goes pale.
Yeah.
And she just walks off. And Eva sees it. And
yeah, because she was supervising.
What did he say? But she can imagine the sort of thing he might have said. And it wouldn't have been, it would just been this cutting single remark that just destroyed this young girl's life.
Yeah.
And it's something that the young girl would never, ever forget. That she'd been told for the rest of her life.
Yeah, and this is the thing that
that's an amazing moment.
That we people in general. And it comes across in a lot of books and movies and things that as we get older we forget what we were like as children or what other, but children are vicious.
Oh, fuck yeah.
I mean,
absolutely.
Kevin is an extreme example.
I was bullied. Yeah. I mean, I know they're fucking vicious. Yeah, they are.
And this is the thing. It's like,
But she's not an extreme example.
Kevin is an extreme example because he goes and kills.
But Lionel Shriver is very clever, or Eva is very clever at pointing out the million other killings that there were around that time.
Which are all real, I think.
I checked a lot of them up.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe how many there were that don't make Australian media. I mean, you think there's been Columbine and a couple of others, but that's about it. They seem to happen every fortnight in America.
Not quite that often.
But didn't you get that feeling that they're just numerous?
Yeah, and it's... and we haven't even touched on the other themes of the book, which talk about, which did come through in the movie in quite a memorable little scene. But when Kevin is talking about, well, you wouldn't, you know, you're essentially, it's kind of the author getting to talk to the reader a little too, because Kevin gets interviewed by one of those sort of hard copy type.
Yep. That's in the film, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a little segment of it. Just a bit of his interview that Eva watches on television.
Yep.
And he's sort of saying to the interviewer, and a lot of it, again, it's Kevin talking.
Yep.
It's him saying stuff and not, you know, some of it's sort of performance. A lot of it's performance. But he's kind of saying, you know, well, you're watching me. Or do you think you'd be watching me if I'd just gotten A's in geography? I mean, this is what – so there's a whole lot of discussion of the celebrity culture and what we rate as interesting, and when we look at the idea of what we watch on television, what we consume as part of our media, the names of people we remember, you know, we still talk about Charles Manson, for goodness sake. It's like there is this cult of celebrity around the anti-celebrity, as it were. And the book looks at that. The book looks at...
Well, Kevin looks at the idea of how he's better than a lot of the other Columbines, et cetera, because...
Yeah, and then he gets really pissed off because another kid, when he's in jail, does a mass shooting and beats his tally by one or two murder victims. I mean, he's really pissed off because he's no longer got the highest tally in...
Yeah, so Kevin's definitely caught up in the concept of a cult of celebrity.
But I think that's a really – I don't think that's a blind caught up. I think he's very calculated.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. What did I say before? Machiavellian?
Yes, exactly. But so there's a lot in this book that's a lot more than just was Eva a good mother or not, which is apparently a huge topic. In my copy there's actually, no, there isn't now that I'm looking at it.
Yeah, no, mine's gone with the questions.
There were questions. I don't know where I came to that, but there were like questions for your book club type of questions. And one of them was...
Seriously, some of these questions are really fucked.
They're really fucked, aren't they? Read a couple of the worst ones out.
Why do people have children when kids are expensive and exhausting and the risk of something going wrong is so high? Well, that's interesting.
But there was one about Eva, wasn't there?
Oh, there's a few.
At the very beginning, I really sort of like blaming questions.
Do you completely trust Eva's version of events? More than once, she admits that she was mistaken about something she assumed that Kevin did. Is she perhaps exaggerating her son's malignancy to make herself seem less blameworthy? Or is she just the only party in this story who foresaw what he was capable of in advance of Thursday?
The less blameworthy part. That's like, what? That implies she is, like, you know, it's sort of, there are some odd reading group questions.
Is Eva a bad mother?
Yes.
Is she too hard on herself? Or is she not hard enough?
Yeah, it's like, really, people have the questions about... And this is
the sort of book you don't need fucking questions at the end of the book to tell you what to ask.
No, you don't.
You do in The Tiger's Wife, because I was struggling.
But apparently one of the great... Because I was reading another interview with Lionel Shriver, and she was saying that she was kind of surprised. She knew the subject matter of the book with the school shootings and everything would make it a hard sell. What she hadn't expected and what she was surprised to find was writing a book about a mother who is questioning whether or not she likes her children, whether or not she's doing a good job, and not in an anguished way, but like a really matter-of-fact way. Yeah. Like the idea of a mother admitting that sometimes she really hates her kid.
Yep.
Is just like, this is this thing that you don't put in books, apparently. Like, it's one of the last taboos. This really? Sort of, well, this was what Lionel Shriver was saying. Like, a lot of questions she was being asked was about this, and I read that bit about from the agent saying,
that's the most shocking thing that people. Well, I suppose it is pretty shocking.
You know,
I thought it would be more the idea that parents may not have any say in what happens to their children and their development in a way. That sense of hopelessness, that I think would be more frightening or more controversial to a parent, especially considering all the toddler books and shit that are out there that we seem to have a fucking bookcase of, about how to, development of your child. That would seem to be more frightening than the idea of a mother not loving her child.
But what's the flip side of hopelessness is absolution. If your kid does really something horrible, then it's not your fault, right? I can't control my kids, I can't influence what they do really when it comes down to it. I'm not able to do that. The flip side of that horror is, well, if they really do something horrible, I'm absolved because I really couldn't do anything about it. So there's that sort of mirror there.
Yeah, okay.
You know, which is what the book talks about as well.
It does.
Because Eva is the one who's blamed. I mean, there's a civil case against Eva.
Brought
by a couple of the parents, one woman in particular, who is blaming her for bringing up a boy who ends up shooting other children.
Which is a really horrible, dark heart of the novel.
But I don't think the novel is cynical about that, because I didn't, for one point, really take the side of any of those parents.
No, of course not.
So the cynicism isn't there. She's pointing out the need for people to find someone to blame. Aside from Kevin, connected to the idea of blaming someone is
the idea that you have influence over your children.
But I think
because if you do something bad, like you don't love them or whatever, then you can be blamed.
But
Eva did everything she could to her within her mind.
To
a degree.
But the fact that this is presented and the way it's presented, and you're still disagreeing with it. I mean, she's done that really cleverly. She's put that out there, but she's not. And as abrasive as Eva can be, and she does herself no good service in that, in her depositions and testimonies in that civil case. You don't ever side with the people who are blaming her for what Kevin did.
I'm in fierce agreement with you.
She's sort of being cynical about that, but she's also saying it's not that simple. I don't think she is. We've been talking about this book for a long time. It's a good book.
It is a great book. It's a book that provokes discussion.
Yeah.
And
I don't think there's any real right reading of the book.
I think the fact that I took a reading of it that based itself around a horror movie cliche, and yet I still saw there was deep-seated. Yeah. There's a real complexity to it, even with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to throw the book against the wall and go, oh, I've read this before.
Because you hadn't.
No. So, no.
It's a unique book at this point in time, I think, because it is – the character of Eva is – when people talk about strong female characters, Eva is exactly the character. I mean, she epitomizes that. It's not as though she's this, super mom. It's not as though she strives through the odds. When I talk about strong, I'm talking about like coffee. Right. Yeah. It's a complexity. It's having a female character who can be abrasive, who can be wrong, who you don't like necessarily all the time.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of representation of women we need a lot more of. And we don't have a lot of it. And I think I think Eva Katchadourian is a phenomenal character.
Agreed. I couldn't agree more.
Excellent. So we're both recommending it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And yes. I am curious for the people who have read it whether they took the same reading as I did on the movie horror movie cliche, but
yeah. You know. It's the first time I've heard that said. I think it's a valid reading. Because I mean everyone is going to come to this book as they do to any other book from their own background of yeah. the culture they've consumed, the people they know. You bring yourself
to
every book.
I thought you'd picked it up because you've probably watched more of those movies than I have. Because you're a sick, twisted woman that you are. But anyway, I enjoyed that.
Good.
That was we had a really good
connection.
Yeah.
See, you need an excellent book to have excellent conversations around.
That is so true.
Because even which is sometimes what I've said to you, and I'm not going to name the books, don't make me, but I've recommended a book in the past, a couple months ahead, and then I've read it and I've said, actually, I'm not doing that one now. And it's not necessarily because I read the book and hated it. It's just I've read the book, it's good, but I can't really say anything for more than 5 minutes about it. I mean, you really need, a good book that's well written, that's complex, that has a lot to say, and that people get different.
The Tiger's Wife does not provoke discussion, other than what everything is wrong with it.
It doesn't.
And can I end off by saying,
yes,
I think there is a dearth, although we've done some this year, of genre novels that provoke the sort of discussion this does. Though a book like Liar, for example, does.
Yes.
There are a few that we've done this year, but I just sometimes feel there's a real.
I think there is. I think there is a dearth. And some of it is the commercial aspect of books. I mean, because we need to talk about Kevin was not a commercial book for a long, long time. It was really hard to sell. It's a commercial book now, but it's become a commercial book kind of through word of mouth, apparently.
Well, we highly
which means it's a good book, but because it was so hard to sell, because so many people turned it down and said this is not a sellable book, this is not a book people want to read, these are the kinds of books that don't get published because it's obviously highly commercial.
Yeah.
So our ideas of what
We've got two separate covers of it.
Exactly, what people should read and what they want to read, and they can be quite disparate with actuality. And the problem is you don't know that because some of these books just aren't getting to people because they're not commercial. Anyway, that's my little rant.
And it was well justified. So
more we need to talk about Kevin's, please. Not in terms of, subject matter or style.
Yeah,
anything.
I don't need
just
stories about slaughtering school children.
Complex books. Yes, complex books that don't offer neat little, here's what I mean.
So all genre writers out there, go on. Listen to Kirsten.
Complex books. Complex books. We don't need neat little packages tied up with bows.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
So we're just coming in under an hour and a half, which is enormously good. I think that's kind of our running time now, 90 minutes.
Yeah, well,
give or take.
As I said, we're a monthly podcast. Yeah. By the time people have missed us,
we're back again.
We're back and we give them 90 minutes
Actually,
of joy.
People do miss us. People say, really? It's like they do. They say, that's a long time between podcasts.
Well,
we should do them more often, but
no.
I'd rather they miss us.
Yeah.
Okay, so lovely people, you can send us feedback about these books or anything else you want to give us feedback about. We are happy to take recommendations if you've read a book that you think is really, really, really good and interesting and crunchy and complex and we can talk about it for 40 minutes. Please let us know. You can comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can send us email to writerandcritic@gmail.com. Or, of course, you can leave us a rating on iTunes if you subscribe that way.
I'm not going to say it. I've said it 13 other podcasts.
Okay. So this was the last episode for 2011, our first full year of podcasting.
Oh,
yay. We made it. But we'll be back in January. And it will be
Well, this will probably won't get released until early January.
I'll have it up tomorrow.
Really?
Of course.
Oh, wonderful.
It's the December podcast.
No. I'm proud of you.
Bad enough I didn't have the November one up in November. Yes. Anyway. Okay, so in January, I recommended Zoo City by Lauren Burkus for you to read, and you have recommended?
Redemption in Indigo by Karen Lord.
Excellent. So we'll be discussing those two books.
A book I have not read.
Okay.
But I'm going to plan the February's book I will have read.
What? I've not read Zoo City.
Da 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 da!
Because the year kind of caught up with me and I didn't have another good book.
Really? Caught up with you?
I did, but I have read Moxieland, which I adored, and I've heard even better things about Zoo City, so I'm sure I'll love it. I'm sure you will too.
Yeah, okay. So, well, look, I want to wish everyone a happy new year.
Yes.
Considering if you're going to get this up on the 29th of December, and
I hope so.
Our avid fans will listen to it the moment it hits iTunes. Yes. So
I think the last podcast of 2011 needs to be up in 2011.
Yeah, that helps. So I want to wish everyone, first off, want to wish you all a great new year. We don't need any floods, tsunamis,
fires,
any of that shit in 2012, in spite of the Mayan prophecy.
No, that's not till what, May or something?
Isn't it later, October?
Well, I can't remember.
Anyway, the point is, we don't need any of that stuff. So we hope I hope you have a lovely 2012.
Yes.
And you, Kirsten?
Oh, thank you. I'd love to have a lovely 2012.
No, you were to say, no, I don't want – you can all die as far as I'm concerned.
Everyone have a horrible 2012.
No, we really do. And
we
do.
We look forward to your company.
Yes, we do.
Your assumed company.
Yeah. Well
– Hello.
That joke really, really took off. That was great. So for me, it's a don't you even think about that stick. I have been wonderful this podcast.
You have.
I haven't said one objectionable thing.
True.
Except for the Rachel. I mean, I don't even say it. It was Ruth Fowler's interview.
Which we'll link to. Anyway.
Yes. So it's a bye-bye from me. So thank you very much.
Goodbye from me, and we'll see you next year.
Yes, we will.
Bye. I'm tired.